I just think you just have to do prison work. Prisons are like the baseball bat they hold over your head. You know, that's the threat. If you're bad and we don't like you, then we'll send you to prison. And it's also, you know, very much the new plantation. Prisoners don't need people to come from the outside and tell them what to do. People need prisoners from the outside to come and ask them, what do you need us to do? These are people, and you have to treat them like people, and then you can learn from each other.
Tonight on Circle 8 Radio, we feature excerpts of a 2-hour interview we did with Rita Bo Brown. Bo Brown is most well known to us as a member of the George Jackson Brigade, a Seattle-based revolutionary group. To learn more about the George Jackson Brigade in general, we recommend the recently published books by Daniel Burton Rose, Guerrilla USA, and Creating a Movement with Teeth. Rita Bo Brown was originally from Klamath Falls, Oregon, and moved to Seattle in the 60s to find community she'd lacked in Klamath Falls. She soon found lesbian bars and political activists. She became radicalized while in prison for a social crime and was reading a George Jackson book when he was murdered in California in 1971. As part of the George Jackson Brigade, Bo Brown robbed banks to help fund their work and the work of anti-war and civil rights action groups. Brown was dubbed the Gentleman Bank Robber for creatively blending her butch cross-dressing style with polite gun-pointing prattle. Brown successfully eluded capture for some time because authorities were searching for a well-dressed man, but was eventually caught and convicted of robbing a Portland bank. She served 8 years in federal prison. After her release in 1987, Brown formed Out of Control, Lesbian Committee to Support Women Political Prisoners, which remains active today. Bo Brown also remains active, doing prison support work and more. We did this interview when she was in Portland in late 2010 for the Raise the Walls mini-conference sponsored by the Ad Hoc Committee to Connect the Dots. The goal of the conference was to nurture a greater understanding of the connections between policing, prisons, and political prisoners.
My name is Bo Brown. I'm an ex-political prisoner. I spent 8 years in the federal prison system. Much of that time, I was in a control unit with Assata Shakur in 1978. And I would say in some form of small group isolation, probably about 4 years of that 8 years. I was a smart kid, so I was in advanced classes. So when I went to high school, I got stuck in the classes with all those rich kids. That was my first real ugly introduction to class and a different level of understanding that and how it was oppressing me. Only I didn't have a language for that. I had a girlfriend in high school from about the age of 16, and we were pretty much deep in the closet. To this day, I've never met another queer from Klamath Falls, Oregon. Although I'm positive they exist, I just have never met them. So I just, you know, had to get out of there. I knew I had to get out of there. In fact, I knew from the age of 5 that I didn't want to be like a housewife or a mother or any of that. And I was a tomboy my whole life. So I had two choices. I decided I had two choices. I could either go to San Francisco or I could go to Seattle because I knew I needed to be in a big city. And I knew somebody in Seattle. So I went to Seattle. Crazily enough, I got a job working for a bank, which I kept that job a couple years. And then I took a civil service test and got a job at the post office, which was a great thing because then I didn't have to wear skirts to work anymore. And there were other little baby dykes who worked there. And I just knew that I didn't want to be these things, but I didn't know really what. So I ran into this guy there. He is a gay man. He was a veteran of the Korean War. So me and him became friends, and he invited me over to his house, and he said, "You have no idea who you are." I said, "Okay." So he took me to the gay bars. And then I had a new home, and that was the gay bars. And I worked swing shift, and I wasn't quite 21, but I think he helped me get some ID. So I hung out in the bars. I worked at the post office, and I discovered the bars, and I discovered wilder women, and I discovered drugs, and I discovered a lot of different things in that time period. I got busted in 1970 or 71 for stealing $50 from the post office. I had a much larger run than that, but that's what they got was $50. And I had a juvenile record, but only one incident. Any sentence less than a year or less, I could have stayed and did like work release. My attorney approved it, the prosecution approved it, and the judge gave me a year and a day. So I went to the penitentiary in 1971 in Terminal Island, California, which is in San Pedro, and it was a federal facility. It was the first time I ever flew on an airplane when the marshals took me to the penitentiary. And I was there about 8 months. During that eight-month period, they instituted what they called a therapeutic community. Their whole theory about rehabilitation at that time was that everybody needed therapy. That was their whole. So they brought in all these therapies, people and students from around the LA area into the penitentiary. They would group with the inmates in the morning, and then they would group with the staff in the afternoon. And although it wasn't mandatory, everybody, of course, knew if you didn't attend, you wouldn't get your good time. So I got put in this group. The most interesting person in this group was not the therapist by any means, but was this woman, this African-American woman named Pearl. Her and I had the same response to this group, which that we didn't talk. But after a group, then we would go to lunch, and then we kind of sort of had the afternoon free. And I was on the landscape crew, so I just got to hang out in the yard wherever I wanted to. So me and Pearl started hanging out a little bit and just talking about the idiocy of this group. So Pearl was part of a group of black women who were reading and talking about stuff. And for some reason, I have no idea what test I passed, but I passed it. She brought me this book and said, I want you to read this book and we'll talk about it. And you cannot show anyone this book. So that book was Blood in My Eye by George Jackson. And I was reading that book when George Jackson was murdered. So I guess that kicked open the politicalization door. And then I went home to Seattle. But they actually, because it was that time period, that little window where they had rehabilitation. So I came up high on this test. So they sent me to community college. And then I couldn't get a job. So I went back to the parole office and I said, look, I've been to all these places. Nobody will hire me. Well, it just so happened that they opened up a two-year program at Seattle Central Community College. So I went there. And then I learned more about these lesbian feminists. I used to go hang out with them, and they took me to International Women's Day at the University of Washington one day, and we went to this workshop, and these two women, I think they were two Quaker women, and they were talking about the women in the jail, and I just got mad because they were just so, you know, that whole do-gooder attitude. So I just stood up, and I expressed my anger. Okay. And they said, well, so what do you have to say? And so I just told them that I had been in that jail, and blah, 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 and they said, well, do you want to do this workshop? And I said, yes. And so that was the first workshop I ever did. And then also going on at that time is there was a school release program, a serious school release program that brought Walla Walla prisoners to the University of Washington. And there was actually an abolitionist movement in that time period. At the community college, there was a prison group. So we said, well, let's start a women's program. They have this brand new prison here that they spent $1 million on. They move the women from Walla Walla. It's all new. It's all clean. It has a decent yard, blah, 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 blah. So we went there, and we met some of the women who were on school release, and we started a prison project called Women Out Now, the premise being that these women are all going to be released, and so they need to know what's available to them in the community. So we brought, like, the bookstores in, we brought the clinics in, we brought loads of literature in. On the weekends, we would bring people's kids in, and the women would come. We were actually still doing this prison group when we went underground. We worked on the Prisoners Union. We worked on there was a newspaper called The Sun Fighter, which went into prisons around the country. There was a lot of stuff happening in prisons. After Attica, there was a lot of stuff. There was a lot of rebellions that happened all over the country. And a lot of people wanted to talk, but a lot of people didn't want to do. And we thought that you had to be more than an armchair revolutionary. So that's how the brigade formed.
We now return to our interview with Beau Brown, ex-member of the George Jackson Brigade, here on Circle A Radio on KBOO, your community radio station.
You have to have money. I mean, the thing about us is that we didn't have money. We aren't big famous names. We don't have big famous daddies. We're not lawyers. We're none of those things. The majority of us were ex-prisoners. We're straight, we're gay, we're queer, we're multiracial. Half of us were women. And we didn't have any money. We would try to get a big bag of money. And then people who were the main participants in this action could disappear for a while and go around the country and see what was going on that they could, you know, kind of hook up with. But that was not a good idea because the police came shooting, shot somebody in the back. Two people were captured. One got shot in the face. The guy across the street who had a rifle fired on the police but was too far away, didn't have enough, I mean, whatever. So those people were in prison, were in jail. One guy died. One guy got shot in the face. So we decided it was time to go. So I went to my community, which was a lesbian community, and I said, okay, I have a pregnant woman of color, ex-convict, living in my house. We had to find a place for her, which we did. My dog went to a farm where he could chase anything he wanted to for as long as he wanted to. My entire house disappeared in a weekend. I have no idea where my grandmother's quilts, where my records are, where any of that is, but it doesn't matter because that worked. And we went down to Oregon. We went to Coos Bay, and then we didn't have any money. We didn't get the money, right? So I became the bank robber because the guy who got shot in the face, he was a little gun shy. And so the first robbery, I got like $1,200. But I didn't care. We had food, and I think we left Coos Bay after that. I don't think we stayed. It was a pretty small town in that time period. And the car we had was an old Volkswagen van that I had stolen from a women's garage that I used to work for. So we had to get rid of that car because the police did visit her. And Brenda, if you're still around, I'm sorry that we had to do that to you, but we didn't really have a choice. And we moved to, I think, Medford or Ashland or somewhere. We stayed around there for a while. We robbed 3 or 4 banks around there. Then we went to Portland. We stayed here for a while. We robbed 3 or 4 banks around here. And then we decided that we had to go back to Seattle. Because if we didn't have a base in Oregon. We didn't have a political base in Oregon. So if we just stayed in Oregon and robbed banks, then we were just bank robbers. So we go back to Seattle. And it's probably 77. And lo and behold, there's a prison struggle going on. As always, right? I mean, that was one of the things that the brigade did in the beginning is blew up the Department of Corrections in the state capitol. We wanted to do something for these prisoners. So what we did is we made 2 small pipe bombs and we sent 2 women, went in and opened safety deposit boxes. And then they went back. And they put these little devices in the safety deposit boxes. And then we called them, and they evacuated. And one bomb went off, and one did not. And we issued a communique that said, here is the connection to all this, right? Who has the money? Who has the interest? And why hasn't they've never interviewed a prisoner. And we were pretty busy up here in Seattle for a while, and then it was time to go. No, because that's the nature of the thing. You have to ebb and flow. And so we were trying to figure out how to do a bigger bank again. And we also severely needed a timeout from each other, which, you know, that's what happens. People, you know, it's a very tense thing and you have to look each other at breakfast every day. And sometimes you don't really want to do that, you know. So we were casing this bank and we did not know how high we had jumped in the list of the FBI's interest. They had a special FBI task force that was the GJB task force that I don't know how many people it was, but I think I've heard that they quadrupled their personnel, and they just flooded the banks with all these pictures. And I had gone to this bank because, of course, I had to go in the bank. And so I went and did my laundry. I took a $100 bill in the bank and cashed it so I could see what was going on in the bank. I had my dog in the car. We went to the beach. We came back. I said, well, let me drive through here one more time. It's a little bit later in the day. Let me see what the traffic is. It was a little strip mall in North Seattle. And I drove through there, and I came out on the other side by this hamburger joint. And as soon as I drove by the hamburger joint, these guys, and they just threw their sodas and everything out of the car, and they were on me like that. So I saw them right away. So I started, like, driving around block, and they were following me because we live not far. That was our plan in this particular thing, was to go to ground right away. So I said, well, I can't do that. I guess I'll go get back on the freeway and drive to Canada, and they'll stop me some whenever they get. Because once they have you, right? You're not going to get away. So I cut through this parking lot because it used to go. There was a big medical facility, and it used to go through to the, and they had blocked off the other entrance. So I had to make a U-turn in the parking lot, and they freaked out, and they jumped out with their guns, and they were all excited, and I just, you know, I really didn't want to get shot. I mean, it's really not my ideal afternoon. And so that's how they got me.
And we rejoin our interview with Bo Brown on Circle A Radio. In 1977, Bo Brown was captured by authorities and sentenced to prison for several armed robberies. She spent her first year in a maximum security unit in Alderson, West Virginia. This was where the, quote, most dangerous women in the country were sent, including Assata Shakur.
During this time period, after Attica, and, you know, riots going on in prisons all over this country about absurd, ridiculous, torturous conditions, Lucasville in Ohio, there was a lot of stuff that happened there. And the men in Lucasville got locked down who were deemed to be leadership of their local rebellion. And so one of the things that they did is they would cut off their fingers with tuna cans that they got from commissary, and they would send them. I'm not quite sure where they sent them, if they sent them to the governor, if they sent them to the president or whatever. They wanted to be sent to Russia because they said it would be better for them to be in a gulag than to be in the United States. And several of them did this. And there was a couple of young women who did this too. So they said, oh, you want to be like the men? So they locked them in the men's prison and ignored them for a long time. And one of them lit a fire, and they just let her burn in the fire for a while. They had an interstate contract with the feds, and they sent them to Alderson. They read everything. They knew who we were. One of them stayed with us. The other one went to California. The one who stayed with us, Cindy was her name, and she just was a big corn-fed girl who had been in and out of prison since she was 12 years old. And so she said, I'm going to live on this hall with you, and they have to come through me before they come to you. And that's what she did. She was our self-appointed bodyguard, which was really good. We had this shrink we called Grape Ape. They hired him from California and sent him there. He was a strange guy. He needed about 10 therapists. But, like, he walked into the unit and walked up to Assata and said, what kind of drugs do you want? And we, of course, told him we didn't want any drugs. He had people Thorazined out in this penitentiary, you know, people who needed not that. And the staff there at that time, they hadn't been specially trained, or they were like people who lived there, and they worked there their entire careers, and they were second or third generation. And a lot of them were nice local people who were just doing a job, and they were not into torture, you know. I mean, a couple of them were, of course, but they were pretty nice people. So they didn't understand him at all. One time he came down to Cindy, and he was always trying to get her on drugs because she, of course, had a medical history. He touched her when she was asleep, and she kicked him in the ball so hard that he flew out the cell and hit his head on the wall outside the window. And she beat that case because psychologically, if somebody wakes you in that manner, the first 10 seconds, you were not responsible. And she was able to quote that, and they were not able to do anything to her. And the people there just thought he was so weird, they actually got rid of him. So we went to them and we said, look, we're going to sue you, and we're going to win because here's the precedent for this case, right? So they set up a program. Every day they had to take us to work. I worked in the garage, in the motor pool, and I can't remember where Assata worked. She worked in the something. Maybe she was an electrician or a plumber, who knows. But they didn't like that. Especially they didn't like that for her. When they decided to close the unit, that's when they came and took her back to New Jersey. And she was there less than a year, and she was liberated. It was a great plan. Worked really well. And she remains free to this day. And even though there's a $1 million reward on her head. when ASADA came there was probably really one of the best things that could have happened to me, because she had been down for like 6 years already in extreme and horrible, disgusting situations, and, you know, inside men's prisons most of that time. And I learned a lot from her. I learned a lot from her about how to survive, how not to let them push my buttons. And not only were we comrades, we were friends. We were friends. And it's important to have friends wherever you are. That was a good thing for me. And I hope it was a good thing for her.
Yeah. That's sweet.
And she's very sweet. So I was in population for about 9 months, I think, till ASADA escaped. And I was in the long-termers unit because I had that much time. And I met Lolita LeBron there before she left. I got to wave her goodbye. Life went on. You know, I had a girlfriend. Then ASADA escaped. When ASADA escaped, they came and got me off the yard and locked me down. And their only reason for that was because she escaped. So I was very confused by that. And the warden would come every day and open up my cell, and I'd say, "What do you want?" And he'd say, "You know, Joanne Chesmire escaped." And I'd say, "Yeah, isn't that funny? Well, you think she's coming to get me or something? Like, what is your problem? Like, I don't understand, right?" "Well, you were friends." "Well, so what?" And I just laugh and go back in my cell and shut the door. And pretty soon, everybody would just laugh when he came, right? During the time period that we were in population working and stuff, I don't know how ASADA pulled this off, but she did. A few of the women from that company came down and did a performance at the penitentiary. And this lawyer, Judy Holmes, came with them, and she had somebody come get me, and she said, and she was clearly a lesbian, and she said, "I'm in D.C., here's my card, let me know if you need anything." So I did. And I called her, and she filed a writ because they locked me down after ASADA left. They had to start taking me to work again, but they wouldn't let me eat in the dining room or go out and do anything else because they wanted to say they were doing something. We won that writ, which was a precedent-setting writ. She did a really good job, and that was used later when they arrested other people because they couldn't lock them down forever without a reason. I came back to court with this little writ in my hand that said, "Yay, yay, you won." And they locked me in a package closet in the administration building, kept me there for a couple, 3-4 hours. And then they took me to the airport and put me on a plane, a little bitty plane, and chained me up and flew me to Chicago, to MCC Chicago. I'd never been to Chicago before in my life. Another one of those high-rise jails. The women's unit there is about, at that time, was about 10 women. There were 700 men in that facility, so the women never got to go anywhere or do anything. And actually, there's this very interesting book I just read called Orange is the New Black by this woman, Piper Kerman. It's about MCC Chicago. She was a upper-middle-class white woman who caught a little case and had to do 15 months. And she did that time at Danbury and at MCC Chicago. And her perspective is worth reading. If I was teaching a women in prison class, I would have people read that. She doesn't talk out her class. It's just her perspective of what she sees and how people are treated. She understands racism. She understands classism. And not because she's an expert on them, but because she sees them. Anyway, so then they took me to MCC Chicago, where I stayed for probably about a year, a little over a year. I finally got a few visitors there. I met these gay socialists who were like law students, and this guy Ron, who actually became the first gay alderman, and they hooked me up with a lawyer there. This guy Leonard Cavice, who's still teaching, I think, at Northwestern, clearly a violation of the writ, so we kept that thing alive. So had a lot of boring experiences there. Then they sent me back to Alderson. I was there 10 days, and Brinks happened. So then they came and got me. I had a little job. I'm working with all the electricians. And it's really like everybody in the penitentiary knows me now. So when I get there, people come and say, here's some sodas for you. Here's some stuff for you. I go up to the rec, which is sometimes on Friday, Saturday night, kind of like the little club. People dance and hang out and play cards and shoot pool, and mostly the straight girls don't come there. And I ran into my friend Miss Two. Now, I don't know Miss Two's story. My suspicion is that Miss Two was a very early M2F surgery. But Miss Two is a character. So Miss Two is playing cards with me, and Miss Two is telling me the most interesting thing that happened while I was gone was that these women came. And I can't remember the name of the action, but all these women surrounded the Pentagon, got in and poured blood on the files and did all this. Well, they sent them all to the penitentiary. There was about 20 of them or something. They had from like maybe 60 days to a year or something like that. And they sent them all there. They just turned out that penitentiary. They held classes. This is why we came to the penitentiary. This is what we did. Two sets of them were lovers, and they couldn't just stop being lovers, so they were locked up all the time. And every time they got out, they just got caught again, and they just, like, had this amazing time. I mean, for these women to observe them and understand what they were doing was a great thing. And they gave these women strength, and they thought that was the best thing that ever happened at that penitentiary. They loved it. So I was there 10 days, and then Brinks happened. They came to my job, and they took me to the warden's house, into the garage of the warden's house. The marshals were there, and they chained me back up, and they took me back to MCC Chicago, where I spent another, 6 months. They were going to send me to the women's prison at Nevada, because it's another one of those that butted up to a men's prison, actually had a gun tower in the men's prison, and they watched over the women's prison, too. I was going to go there, and then they didn't take me. I had to wait 30 days. And so then they took me, and I found out why I had to wait 30 days is they had a pretty horrible administration there. It was all male in the women's prison. And they had this sadistic shrink who had this woman on some pretty heavy meds and had her locked down. And she was screaming and hollering all night, and they didn't go check on her, and she died. So the next time the doctor came, all the women went out in the yard and found pebbles and stoned this doctor and then went back in lockdown. So they now had a different warden in the women's prison. It was a woman. She was a member of NOW and considered herself a feminist. They had a captain and a lieutenant who were actually a lesbian couple who were in charge of security. And they had a woman doctor, which were all important changes in how things happened there, which was all a good thing for me, I think. Because it allowed me to do a lot of things there. I was a law clerk there. I was a jailhouse lawyer there. And I worked in the kitchen. And this guy was getting ready to retire, so they sent him there, and he was just ready to retire. And he was a pretty decent human being, so I had my little stash in the freezer. And I could eat whenever I wanted to. I got to live with my lover there. We were cellmates for a while. That was very nice.
We now rejoin our interview with Rita Bo Brown, ex-political prisoner and former member of the George Jackson Brigade, here on Circle A Radio.
I was paroled in January the 4th of 1986. And 6 months later is when they opened the control unit in Lexington. It was in the basement of the hospital. It was absolutely the perfect definition, textbook classic of a control unit. It was painted all white. The guards were predominantly male. The women were locked down all the time. They could be seen taking their showers. They had to ask the guards for one Kotex at a time. Susan Rosenberg went there, Alejandrina Torres went there, and they took Sylvia Baraldini, who I had met at Pleasanton, who had already been down for a while and who actually had just had a custody reduction to medium custody, and they picked her up and took her to this control unit. So we started a group called Out of Control to work on this issue. And there were several people around the country. And that's what we did for 2 years. It took 2 years to get them to get ready to go to court. And they knew they would lose. There was no program. They took people right from court. They had put two social prisoners in there who had longer time. They could say it wasn't a political thing, but it clearly was a political thing. And it went to court. They lost. They closed the unit. They sent those women then to Mariana, Florida, which was a brand new women's prison built inside a brand new men's prison, so that they had restricted movement. But it was certainly better than what they had. And then Out of Control became Out of Control Lesbian Committee to Support Women Political Prisoners, which still actually exists. There's only three of us left. 88 to now, what is that?
22.
Oh my God, okay, yeah. What we did is we worked with another group, Legay, and we did this benefit every year called Sparks Fly, in which we raised money for the commissary fund. And we got, you know, wherever we could get money for the commissary fund, we got commissary. And we worked with people in the lesbian, gay, LGBT community to donate their talent. So we had like all kinds of people. And we did this every year, and we raised money, and we had a newsletter, and we sent the money to the women. We divided it up. And at one time, I think there was either between 15 and 20, and that included the MOVE women. We had a booth at the gay parade every year. We tried to march in the gay parade every year and just hand out information about the women political prisoners. And that's what we did for years and years and years and years and years. And we had this big sandwich board thing that had the women's pictures on it and their stories and where they were. And people would come every year and see us and say, what's happening with those women? And I would just make up a packet, a little information, and I would say, here, put this in your backpack, take it home, put it in your bathroom. When you're sitting there, read this stuff, right? It was a really good thing. I mean, people came, people knew, people learned that we had political prisoners. Me and another woman rode our bikes on Dykes on Bikes 1 year, and our theme was, there are lesbian political prisoners. And we put that all over our bikes, and people paid attention. Put Linda Evans, I put Susan Rosenberg, I put Laura Whitehorn, I put them on the back of my bike. They were a milk carton on the back of my bike. But we did that. Like, we did that. I think that we let people in our community know that there were political prisoners. And we did that for years. And we still continue, and we had a newsletter called Out of Time. And until very recently, we probably had maybe 1,000, mostly women inside prison, who got this newsletter. And we were able to keep it alive through community support. But, you know, times are very hard. We did it with Legay because we used their printer. And then it got put inside their newspaper, and then it got put in newspaper stands in San Francisco. And we've had to cut that down to one page that's within their newspaper. And we're working with that format now, trying to, like, just keep it alive. And we actually had started a lesbian pen pal thing in the newsletter, but we can't do that now. We don't have the time to, like, just pay attention to it. That was actually an interesting thing. I think that was really important, but we can't do it right now. Come to work with us, and we'll let you do the lesbian pen pal column. And I work with the Prison Activist Resource Center, and which was 10, 12 years probably. These young folks came down from Evergreen. And they had a prison group at Evergreen, and they started the Prison Activist Resource Center. And then they were very instrumental in the first critical resistance. I was on the board for a long, long time. I didn't have a lot of time because I was doing all those other things. But I lived in San Francisco for 10 years, and then I moved to the East Bay, and now I live in Oakland. And I've lived there for 13 years, 14 years, something like that. And now I have more time, so I actually go to park 3 times a week. I probably put in about 10 hours a week there. It's an all-volunteer organization. We send a resource directory, a national resource directory, to any prisoner that requests it. And that's anywhere, well, around 5,000 prisoners a year. You can go to prisonactivist.org and check out our website. You can also get the directory and download it there. We try to upgrade it every year or so. It's just been upgraded in August. Have a wonderful insurgence of youth now. I have about 10 volunteers, which is really good. So I'm trying to figure out, work with them and figure out how to divide up the labor. It's really about the website, and it's really about the directory. So we're beginning a process now where people pick what they want to do, and then they get to make it what they want it. And we just all work together and figure out what that is. Because then they don't have to come to the office every day to do it either. I still go to work every day. I work 40 hours a week. I've worked at the same job for 20 years, a little more, 22 years. Emma and I get to retire in about 3 years. I just think you just have to do prison work. Prisons are like the baseball bat they hold over your head. You know, that's the threat. If you're bad and we don't like you, then we'll send you to prison. And it's also, you know, very much the new plantation. Sometimes you have to have strange alliances. I've been in a situation where I had to go to the bikers and say, look, we have a problem, right? We have to deal with this stupid police that's on our unit now. And we don't have to become friends and we don't have to become anything else, but we have to deal with this. And that means that you have to deal with these other people that you usually talk about. And they have to deal with you, right? And so we have to make a plan. And I think that's sort of because we knew how to do that, kind of, that we were able to understand the commonality of the enemy. If you want to change the world, then you have to have honor. And you have to have that in every hour of your day. And that's not an easy thing to learn. Because especially for white people, our culture allows us to not be honorable. Part of the privilege that we get is to not be honorable. And it's okay. And you could say that, you know, for sexism, that's true. Men get privileged and they don't have to be honorable in sex because it's not necessary. I mean, you could say that about anything. Whoever is the privileged party in the question does not really have to be honorable. They just have to pretend to be honorable or make it look like they're honorable. So it's really about what you want to be. Do you really want to be different? And you have to create an atmosphere in which you can discuss that with each other. And you cannot expect the women to teach the men, the people of color to teach the white people. Like, you need to, like, deal with yourselves. Like, those other folks who are the people that you are oppressing can have enough to put up with every day. And that's not easy. That's probably the biggest challenge. Even though you think maybe robbing the bank and getting away is the biggest challenge, it's really not. That's tactics and strategy. That's technicality. The real change has to be within.
You have been listening to an interview with Bo Brown, ex-member of the George Jackson Brigade, here on Circle A Radio. To learn more about the George Jackson Brigade, check out the recently published books by Daniel Burton Rose, Guerrilla USA, and Creating a Movement with Teeth. Circle A Radio is on the first and third Wednesday of every month from 6 to 7 p.m. here on KBOO Portland. You can listen to past shows or contact us by visiting our website, www.kboo.fm/Circle A Radio. You can also show your support for us by logging on to kboo.fm and making a donation, or by calling 503-232-8818. Thanks for listening.